I'm Holly Case of Cornell University, and this is East Central Europe Past and Present, a blog series that brings you interviews with scholars of East Central and Southeastern Europe, Russia, and the former Soviet Union, in which they offer their views of the past, present, and future of the region. So today I'm in New York City, where I'm on leave this year, and I'm talking with Małgorzata Mazurek, who is a historian of Poland. And she's also soon to be the first to occupy the Polish Studies professorship at Columbia University here in New York. And since completing her doctorate at Warsaw University, that was in 2008, Małgosia has authored two books in Polish, one in 2005 titled Socialist Factory, Workers in Communist Poland and the GDR on the Eve of the 1960s, and another in 2010 titled Society in Waiting Lines on Experiences of Shortages in Post-War Poland. She has also authored or co-authored a number of articles in English, and her current book project deals with the intellectual history of East Central European involvement in the making of the Third World between the early 1940s and the late 1960s. So thank you for agreeing to talk with me today, Małgosia.
Thank you.
So I want to start basically at the beginning. you probably caught the last years of socialism in Poland. Can you talk about how your experience of that period, or what your basic experience of that period was, and then perhaps talk a little bit about how your memory of it has changed over time, if it has?
Well, excellent question. I was born in 1979, mm-hmm. and I remember very well 1984 because of the famous George Orwell's book that was discussed at the time in Poland, and my father, who read many books in English and was an fluent English speaker, read this kind of literature. But my family was in no way affiliated with political opposition, and I grew up in a house where we had that was both Germanophile and Russophile, and also with Polish Jewish origins, with Jewish roots, and mm-hmm. Involvement in socialist and communist politics since the mid 20th century, basically. So my grandfather was involved in and his whole family basically was very active in Socialist Party and later in the Communist Party on a kind of middle rank level. So I didn't remember any samizdat at home or meetings that my parents would have with you know, colleagues from the opposition or the underground, but it was definitely quite a gloomy memory of you know, strange everyday life that I guess later became even more interesting for me under its, you know, in its capitalist version. But I also remember a lot that everything was changing all the time in the 80s. My father was changing jobs, and I thought that like children who go each year to different class at school, the adults also change jobs every year, you know, on the 1st of September. And my parents were thinking about changing their jobs in the state sector. They were both academics and worked in did some research to become you know, entrepreneurs and set up some little what would be called today a startup, mm-hmm. and do something else than their state job. So there were a lot of things happening. As a child, I remember that there was some kind of I guess, insecurity also, and not much money at home. This kind of things come to my mind. And I very, very well remember 1989, mm-hmm. because I was traveling with my school choir. I went to a music school, and we went to Bulgaria in May 1989 to participate in a choir contest in Varna. Mm-hmm. And it was for me the first time when I saw so many Eastern European countries. Mm-hmm. We went through Ukraine, Romania, we stayed in Suceava, mm-hmm. then south towards the Danube and Romanian-Bulgarian border, and then we stayed in Sofia. And it was for me an amazing discovery, because once we went back the same route and we came to Warsaw, suddenly the whole city appeared to me as a extremely festive and colorful place, because it was just before the semi-free elections of, I guess it was June 4th, 1989, and there were so many posters on the streets and people discussing, and this landscape that we just passed by seemed to be much more static and kind of very different from what was happening these days in Warsaw. So it was interesting comparison.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of questions that this raises. perhaps we could go back to the issue of your family. You said it was Germanophile, Russophile, and you had some Jewish roots. Could you talk a bit about, you know, like the different branches of your family and how they came to be Germanophile, Russophile, mm-hmm. you know, where the Jewish roots were, like how your family, extended family, lived through the Second World War and communism? I mean, that would just be really interesting.
Well, my family, taken as a whole, my parents of my parents mm-hmm. Represent basically the whole strata and, you know, cultural groups of the Polish society. So on my mother's side, it is a family of what was called after World War II peasant workers. Mm-hmm. They lived close to Warsaw, 5 children, Catholic family, fighting during the young men fighting during World War II in some underground organizations, mm-hmm. and my mother and her siblings were the first generation who obtained higher education mm-hmm. in that family, and my all of them in hard sciences and. Two of my aunts are engineers, and so it's somehow...
So this was in the 50s, or no, it was later, much later, 60s,
in the
70s.
Okay. 70s. So it's also kind of typical experience mm-hmm. of social ascent under communism that was also quite free from some political overtones. It didn't mean that my mother's family was somehow... grateful to the communist state, but this was definitely an important experience to be able to raise 5 children and give them higher education. My father, on the other hand, grew up in a family where there were his mother was from a Schlachta, so this is
a nobility, right?
Nobility. Mm-hmm. And she rebelled when she was young. It was, you know, just at the end of the World War II. She joined PPR, Polish Workers Party, mm-hmm. Which was a kind of follow-up of Polish Communist Party, and. She rebelled again when she met my grandfather, who was Jewish, and I think this is an experience of some of these noble women right after the war, who not only joined the party but also married men whom they were not supposed to marry.
Where was she from originally?
She grew up in Warsaw.
Okay.
And her father was a professor of agricultural sciences. I'm not sure what would be the name of it.
Yeah, I think so.
It's English equivalent. And this family, the history of my Jewish grandfather is extremely interesting, and this is where maybe this Russophilia and Germanophilia appears or comes to the picture, but in a very strange way. My grandfather had to hide during World War II because he had a so-called bad look, black, dark eyes and black hair. And his sister and his mother were blondes, so they had spent occupation under false papers with the false identities, and they secured apartments and hideouts where he could stay. And when
this was in Warsaw, as
it was between Krakow and Warsaw. So, of course, what happened is that this family moved to Krakow, from Krakow to Warsaw, because in Warsaw nobody knew them, and it was easier to live under false Polish, Catholic, ethnically Polish identity.
So before that, it was a bourgeois family, roughly. I mean, what did they do in Krakow?
My grandfather was a piłsudczyk. He was a military officer, a professional military officer, involved in Polish military affairs. He fought in Polish Bolshevik War, and then remained in the military service until the end of the 20s.
Wow.
And then he set up his own accounting company, firm, and then he also decided to set up a small factory near Krakow, but Second World War interrupted all these plans. And he eventually died in Bełżec, the concentration camp. So these Polish connections didn't help him really.
Do you know how long? I mean, because he must have been a Polish patriot at least initially. Do you know whether he was a Polish patriot to the end, or you know what his thought trajectory was in the interim?
This is very hard for me to reconstruct. I only know that there were always sympathies towards Polish Socialist Party. Present at home, they all spoke perfect Polish. My grandfather and his sister. And I think it was, I know very little, since there is no correspondence and no memoirs, and I know very little about it. But his wife, who survived the war, my grandmother and her two children, immediately joined Polish Socialist Party when the war was over. And this also is a quite funny story, and funny and tragic, because when they left Warsaw after they didn't fight in the Warsaw Uprising, they stayed on the right bank side, which was then occupied by the Soviet army and the Polish army fighting with the Soviet army on the side of the Soviet army. They went to Lublin, which was the new capital of the new socialist Poland, right? They all got jobs related to the government somehow.
So this is also includes your grandfather?
Yes, so my grandfather, who was back then maybe 22.
Mm-hmm. And he also joined the party together?
He joined the party, PPS, Polish Socialist Party, and he was very active also as a child in the socialist youth movement. Mm-hmm. And after the war, he was organizing together with his sister an organization called TUR, Association of Workers' Universities, kind of higher education for working adults. Mm-hmm. And he also thought about becoming a professional agitator for the land reform. Mm-hmm. And he was just about to start his job when the Soviets who stationed in Lublin at the time organized a kind of so I don't know what is the name of it in English, a raid into one of the cafes in the city. Mm-hmm. And arrested most of the young men who were there looking for basically home army people or those who are somehow affiliated with the military underground.
Oh, it's sort of like that film, right? Is it Ashes mm-hmm. and Diamonds?
Or yes, exactly. But you know, my grandfather back then lived already under a false name.
Oh.
My name, Mazurek, is a peasant name of the peasant family who gave shelter to my family during the Holocaust. And it was also an excellent name, you know, it's
Mazuri. Yeah.
it's a very typical name that has no connection with actually my family's past. Neither it's
what was his name before, his family's name?
Feil.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was old. My grandfather was also arrested, and he said, "This is a misunderstanding. You know, I didn't fight on the side of the home army. I was not fighting against Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just using this propaganda style that was, you know, targeted against home army, which was accused of, you know, being basically an enemy of the Soviet Union, but." They didn't listen, and they said, "You are Adam Mazurek, and we take you to the camp." And so he was sent with many other people who were indeed in the Home Army and, you know, other underground military organizations to one of the Soviet labor camps. And now I'm trying to recall the name of it. But it was quite far away from Poland.
So it was definitely in the Soviet Union.
Yes, it was in the Soviet Union. So he spent another 2 years in that camp before he was able to come back. But that, you know, didn't prevent him from changing his political affiliation. So he...
You mean he stayed socialist?
He stayed socialist.
Was part of that, I mean, what was his experience in the camp? It must have been, like, the Home Army people must have recognized him as not a Home Army person. You know?
Well,
or how did that work? I mean,
well, as far as I know, but I know it just from my father, because my grandfather died when I was a little girl. He was a very charming man, and he made friends very easily. Mm-hmm. So when he, during his funeral, many old co-prisoners from that Soviet camp came to, you know, pay tribute to his, you know, life and his death. And apparently he had many, many friends among people who he befriended, you know, under these strange circumstances. But there is also another quite amazing twist in that story, because when he came back to Poland and found a job in the Ministry of, I guess, Foreign trade or internal trade, if I'm one of the, you know, ministries of the new Polish state, one of the female workers also who also worked for that ministry recognized him and said that accused him of betraying her or giving her in during World War II, and she accused him of collaboration with the Nazi with the Nazis who came to Krakow in 39 and were conducted at the very beginning of the occupation made lists of people who belonged to Jewish community, allegedly to collect taxes, but these lists later served had a very different and, you know, deadly function. And this this woman was Jewish, but she became Christian at the end of the 30s. She converted into Catholicism. And when he collected this data as a young 18-year-old boy for the Jewish community, he came to her house and said, and wanted to put her on the list, and she didn't want to be enlisted, and it definitely must have put her in danger afterwards. But after World War II, when the Jewish community was settling scores, you know, internally, he was accused of collaboration. I found it by sheer accident. I was doing research about something else, and I went to Jewish Historical Institute, and I just found this big file with my grandfather's name from the trial that took place in the Jewish CKZP, Central Commission of Polish Jewry, and it was in 1948. So there is all these things that I discovered as a young adult really made me aware of, you know, a very complicated biographical trajectories
How did that trial end? I mean, what happened?
Well, he was not
acquitted,
but he was also not sentenced. Right, so they basically said, well, he didn't know what's coming, and also in his there was one thing that worked in his favor, that after this woman came to his family in 39 and told the whole story, you know, told my grandfather's parents, you know, you put me in, your son puts me in danger, and I don't want to be on any kind of list that, you know, Nazi occupiers are doing. He the very same day he stopped working for the the Jewish Council. So, and later on, his all his wartime experiences were also very dramatic. He wasn't capo, you know. He didn't work in the camp as a kind of, you know, in Ordnungsdienst or any kind of function that would be very ambiguous. He wasn't acquitted, but he wasn't sentenced.
Mm-hmm. So, and what did he end up becoming? Was he an academic, did you say?
He became a journalist for a short time, actually. When he was put on when he was accused. Well, the thing is that he was informally accused, and so to speak, everybody knew it. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, early, it was mid-48, I don't remember exactly the year, but it was he, my grandfather himself, who came to the Central Committee of Polish Jews and said, I would like to have this trial because I want to clarify this issue. Mm-hmm. And it was also important politically because he was active in the Polish Socialist Party, and it was a time when the purges in the Polish Socialist Party started already before this big congress of unification with the communists, when socialist merged with communist and when Polish United Workers Party was set up. So I think it had some connection with these party purges, and he wanted to be clean before anything like that happened. But it's also more a reconstruction and a little bit speculative statement. So I'm not exactly sure. But he became a journalist, and he would write about Stakhanovist movement in the early 50s, and wrote for a journal Robotnik, which was a very important, the most important socialist daily newspaper in the post-war Poland. But he didn't make any career in the ranks of the Communist Party, and basically in the early 50s he moved to another job, which was, you know, editing, job of an editor in some state-owned press publishing house. And so he basically gradually moved from being a, you know, very promising young journalist who knew many different languages. He also wanted to be a diplomat, but I guess this all his, you know, his stay in the Soviet Union and then very complicated trajectory, I'm sure, didn't help him to become part of this of the diplomatic corpus. So he basically ended up as a middle rank, you know, very well educated, you know, I don't know what would be the function.
Functionary,
exactly, functionary. This is the best.
What about your rebel grandmother? I mean, what became of her?
Well, she also didn't make any spectacular career.
Did her family stay in touch with her, or were they?
Yes, they did. They did, and they had quite good relations. So she had good relations with her parents and with her sisters. I know very little about this part of family, but my grandmother became one of the, it's also typical for women of the generation, especially so well-educated women, an editor in the party journal Nowe Drogi.
New path.
It was ideological periodical of the Communist Party, where everything, all the most important political texts were published.
So that brings us, like, to your parents, right? So then your parents were both academics.
They are both geologists, and I think what they met at the university, and it's very interesting to.
And this is in Warsaw.
This was in Warsaw, and before they met, there was 68, and this is also very important because they met in 69, But in already in 67, after the 6 days war, my grandfather lost his job. And he was back. He was at the time working for state-owned firm dealing with the foreign trade called Metallexport. And because he knew German very well, he knew Russian very well, and he knew French also perfectly. He worked as a translator and you know, functionary in this firm, and so he lost his job and he lost his party card, and his wife didn't. No, she my grandmother, she stayed in the party until the last days of the Polish Workers' Party, or you know, Communist Party, and you know, until 1990. So he lost the job, and it's interesting because there was a question of what to do, and his sister and his mother also lost their jobs. His sister was a much more successful journalist, and she also went through this humiliating procedure that she throwing her out from the
party.
I think it was quite difficult for her, and so while my grandfather's mother and sister went to West Germany because they decided to leave Poland and settle somewhere else, and again German language that they knew from the Krakow time, not from the war time, but from their interwar lives. My grandfather stayed, I think because of this intermarriage, of this you know, marriage with the non-Jewish person, it was harder for him to leave, and my grandfather didn't want to emigrate anywhere. And so my grandfather, as a 20-year-old student of geology, he was born in 1948. Yes, my father also did something that I didn't understand, and I don't understand, and which steers my inspires my interest for history. And right after March 68, that all of those who know Polish history well, was a traumatic time for all remaining Polish Jews who and some parts of the Polish intelligentsia, his decision was to join the Communist Party. So in the spring 1968, when Havdi's family was leaving and his father was unemployed, he joined the Communist Party. And I cannot tell you why, because each time I ask him, he gives me a different answer. So, but you know,
your mother? I mean,
I don't know, but this is something that I really don't get until today. And I knew that story as a, you know, as a teenager, I didn't know anything about the Jewish past of my grandfather. It was a complete taboo.
Really?
We weren't Catholic, but nobody was talking about any kind of Jewishness of my family.
So
in my family.
Did you grow up more or less atheist? Or?
Yes, fully atheist. So it was a puzzle, and it remains a puzzle, and what kind of choices people had to make or were confronted with is something that fascinates me very much. And
is that how you, I mean, is it things like that that brought you to the study of history, or how would you narrate your trajectory to the study of history? And you also studied sociology, right?
Well, I think it's some I think there are two levels. One level is that I really like to observe. I'm a very curious person, and I was fascinated by how everything was changing since I was a little girl. You know, basically, you know, every couple of months there was a new shop. The city of Warsaw where I grew up was changing extremely fast, and so I thought it's, you know, one of the most interesting things you can do is to study the change that was happening, and then but also understand, you know, where does it come from and what was being replaced by what, you know. And I think it's, you know, I really thought about it this way, I guess, at that time.
So were there others like you of your generation who were thinking in the same terms, or did you feel yourself alone in this interest? I mean, because there was a resurgence of interest in history after the collapse of communism, but it wasn't necessarily in the history of socialism.
Yeah.
And so, like, to what extent did you find a community of others with like interests?
Well, I think I was quite... I was interested in history, and I did it quite actually on my own. So I was doing myself a lot of oral history in the high school. I went to people, and my first, my oral history project was about daily life under cultural and daily life under Stalinism. And I did interviews about cafes and this de-Stalinization and how people experience this moment of melting of the thaw, basically, and how.
And you did this in high school.
Yeah.
And how did people? So this was you. This was the mid-90s.
Mid-90s.
How did what was your experience of talking to people about this, and were they excited to be talking about it, or was there some, were there peculiarities of the way that they narrated it that struck you?
Well, if I remember correctly, you know, all these people were somehow related to this, you know, liberal circles of Warsaw intelligentsia. So I think I wasn't very surprised by what they were saying. I think I was very much surprised by the sense of social belonging they had, because I used to think that my own experience was that my parents were quite disconnected from, they didn't have a group of friends with whom they shared their interests or just, you know, celebrated some kind of sociability. Mm-hmm. And I was, and also would never talked about politics, and the my father's family was basically not non-existent, so there was basically only my grandfather who was still alive, and I was quite cut off from my other parts of the family. So I had a very narrow understanding of social worlds, and I, during these interviews, I discovered that there was, that people had so many different affiliations and lived in various, you know, social circles. I mean, it all sounds very general, but I think what I discovered was that, you know, I discovered definitely political opposition in these interviews, and I discovered something I didn't know myself from the 80s, namely this kind of bourgeois or middle class lifestyle that somehow
persisted
in the post-war time.
So do you think that your own parents' relative isolation was a function of the time in which they grew up, or a function of their particular, like, class, if we can call it? Or, I mean, how do you explain that now, the difference between that generation?
Yeah, I was thinking about it a lot. So I think definitely it was not the function of time, because I went to a first non-state school in Poland, which was set up basically in the summer of 89, mm-hmm. and all my friends grew up in the families with, you know, either anti-communist or kind of dissident or oppositional traditions, or definitely quite liberal. And I felt a little bit as an outsider, as you know, somebody who cannot say, you know, my parents and I spent all the summers with our groups of friends who are at the same time writing, you know, articles for some Samizdat newspapers and listen to Bułat Okudżawa and so on. So I didn't know anything about that. And I was also fascinated by this courage that people have to express themselves in the, you know, 70s and 80s. All these stories about opposition I found fascinating, because the only story I knew was a kind of, you know, a kind of smallish act of what I would of you know, access to the Communist Party, mm-hmm. when my father confronted this you know, in the, of the 68. So I thought it was a kind of very strange combination, and I wasn't ashamed by any way by what my father did. I found it, I was fascinated by it, but it was the only family story that I could share with others, and I didn't share. I left it for myself, and it just, I guess, somehow grew in me, and I was dealing with all these complexities by asking other people.
Oh, I see.
How they lived and what they experienced, and always looking for some kind of diversity, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I had hard time to listen to this national Polish patriotic stories, because they were very foreign for me, very distant culturally, you know, also really not being not part of the Polish Catholic community. Mm-hmm. Or kind of Polish Catholic nation, I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, it was already a quite alienating experience. So, you know, writers like Henryk Sienkiewicz were banned in my house, because
really?
My father used to say that
I
he was an
anti-Semite,
and so on and so on. And also that, you know, very anti-clerical attitude of my... of both of my parents, because my mother basically converted from Catholicism to atheism when she met my father.
Oh, I see.
So she was solidaric with his worldview and started to share it. Mm-hmm.
Did you notice anything about the way that your parents narrated their experience of socialism after the collapse of socialism? I mean, did they have different stories about how they fit into it, or what it meant after, over time, or how do they talk about it now?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you asked me about being self-reflective and thinking about history. This is what I had to develop myself without any experience of it in my family, because my parents never talked about the past and about history.
Mm-hmm. Or politics of the day, or
very little. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a kind of daily life, what we do, and kind of little, you know, mm-hmm. little small stability, like looking for kind of normalcy all the time, without much thinking, or basically without much expressing any kind of doubts.
Do you know what their politics are now, or what they have been since?
Yeah, so my parents, you know, they had, they worked at, they had this, you know, middle rank jobs at university. Mm-hmm. My father then switched to research institute, and so he stayed. An interesting thing that he did it after 89, he became an expert in the Polish forensic office, which is, and he started to work for the police.
On what kinds of stuff? I mean, he's a geologist.
Yes, but he switched to organic chemistry, and he became a specialist on drugs.
Oh, interesting. And so after the transition.
And what was interesting, I guess, that he never left the Communist Party, which gave me a chance to see the last celebration of Polish-Soviet friendship. It was, I guess, in 1988 in the Polish, in the Warsaw Palace of Culture and Science. Yeah. And I remember there was a one folk group from Poland and one folk group for some place in the eastern Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And so this was this kind of waning socialism that, you know, I experienced as a still as a 9-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. But he never, I think he never, but if I remember correctly, he would say that he didn't give up his party card because he liked to be socially involved. He was a kind of an activist, not in a political sense of the word, but he liked to, you know, be on the committee of this, on the committee of that, be the secretary, gather kind of monthly fees somewhere, like doing something in within some kind of under umbrella of an organization. Mm-hmm. And this was his explanation why he stayed until the end in the
eventually in the party. It was gone, and then what?
And it was gone, and he voted for, you know, people of his class, so you know, people like Tadeusz Mazowiecki. So, you know, it was, for him, it was just like, you know, choosing one of the people he belonged to, you know, culturally and socially, but, you know, politics were, you know, not really an issue. So it was more a kind of, I would say, aesthetical choice, you know. He seems to be an intelligent guy, and I think it was much more complicated than that.
So let's go back to 1984, right? Because, you know, at first when you said 1984, I thought you were talking about the year, but you were actually talking about the book. Mm-hmm. But approximately at the same time, right?
So yeah, because I remember that my parents would say that this is it's supposed to be a very strange year, and there is this book, and...
And so did you read that book? Did you know what was in it? Did they talk about it? Or is it just...
Well, back then I was, you know, I didn't know English, and I was
little,
very little girl. I really remember this sense of I try not to, you know, invent things now, like ahistorically, but it's very hard. I'm aware of it.
It's so, because it, you know, on the face of it, it's quite strange because, you know, your parents were members of the party and yet they were reading this book. And then, you know, how did it fit into their thought universe? Or maybe they didn't think it was, maybe they didn't associate it with Poland.
I think they thought it's part of the Western literary canon. As, you know, they read it, my father read it as much as he read Punch, a British magazine, as much as he read Umberto Eco, I remember.
Wow.
The name, I remember that book. I was fascinated by the colorful covers, so I was like, what is it? Yeah, and you know, and back then I think, you know, there were very good films shown on the TV, although I remember that my parents went to some kind of illegal screening of Blechtrommel.
Oh, right, the tin drum.
Yeah. And I was very intrigued that they don't show it on in the cinema, like the, you know, Farewell with Africa with Meryl Streep and Robert Redford. It was one of the first film I saw in the cinema.
Oh, well, remember,
but
yeah.
But they went to some kind of, you know, illegal screening, and it was not in the cinema. So some glimpses of it were there, and I don't think that, you know, my parents, like I guess many others, were somewhere on the margins of this, you know, politically involved, mm-hmm. of this political life. So they were, since they were, you know, Warsaw intelligentsia, they were aware of things happening, and sometimes maybe they would go somewhere, mm-hmm. but they were in no way involved, mm-hmm. neither in, you know, kind of, you know, power games of the Communist mm-hmm. Party or nomenklatura, you know, functions, neither in kind of more, you know, on the other, nor neither on the other side. So neither this nor that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the most significant event in your own life that you've witnessed, and how did you experience it?
The most important event in my life?
Yeah.
Historical?
I mean, that you would call probably historical, even if, you know, it's out of phase with the usual timeline. It doesn't have to be. Something you experienced where you felt like this is significant, you know, at the time.
Yeah, well, I think definitely I remember that this 89 elections were so important, and I started to think about something more than school and my girlfriends and what I'm singing or what I'm playing on the piano, and I became much more aware that there is some kind of so-called social reality around me, although it was a very personal experience. So I was a 10-year-old person, but I remember, for example, graffiti on the streets that was very anti-communist. I started to learn that there is something like politics, mm-hmm. and then I definitely started to learn that there is something like economy, because money became such an issue, and siblings of my mother lost their jobs after 89, and my parents struggled a little bit, although they had, all of a sudden all their savings in dollars evaporated. It's lost basically their value because dollar was so strong under communism, and during the hyperinflation of the very early 90s, all these dollar savings basically lost their stopped being this very powerful hard currency, and you know, in relation to zloty. And so I remember it because my older brother became in the end a financial expert, and my father somehow became fascinated with banks, and he would go to bank, you know, twice a week to do something. He just liked banks. So, you know, I didn't go to First Communion, but instead we went. My father said, you know, rather than going to First Communion, a kind of a day when you, and this is maybe one of these memorable days, it's not a very historical event, but it's an interesting kind of, you know, initiation, rite de passage, you know, ritual. We went to a headquarters of Polish bank Pekao, and my father set up an account for me, and he put there $1,000, which I spent when I came to New York 1 year ago. But but this was a kind of lesson. Look, this is a bank account. Here is the percentage. This is, you know, saving is about this and that. So.
And this was when?
It was 1990, maybe 1991, something like that. Mm-hmm. But really, you know, in my later, a kind of very important historical event was the publication of The Neighbors by Jan Tomasz Gross. Uh-huh. And this was something that shook me and completely changed my perception of, you know, made me very politically aware and made me aware of stakes of the history, you know, and I found all my interest in socialism and in everyday life a kind of a secondary vis-a-vis the issue of Polish-Jewish relations and what is now called what happened on the peripheries of the Holocaust, where ethnic Poles were, you know, directly involved in killing Jews. So it was really a shock for me when I read this book.
And when did you read it?
It was just when it came out. Was what, 2001?
I don't remember exactly, but
I think even earlier, 2000 even, maybe? 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm. And so you were like 20, 21 at the time?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you were in college, and so was it assigned, or did you just read it?
No, I don't know how I think there was a one article in Gazeta Wyborcza. I used to read Gazeta Wyborcza every day since my high school years. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with you know, interest, sometimes with frustration, but I used to read it a lot. And I bought the book really after, just after it came out, and I read it first myself, and then we talked about it in our little seminar about history of ideas run by Dariusz Gawin and somebody else. But it was an interesting seminar because it was attended by people like Sławek Sierakowski, who is now my friend from the same
cohort.
You know, cohort at university, and we had really a lot of interesting discussions about, you know, intellectual history of Poland and ideas. I basically discovered you know, the very world completely unknown to me, which is, you know, Polish right-wing politics. I had no traditions of the right-wing politics, Dmowski and others. I had no idea that something like that existed, you know, when I really realized I was very isolated from anything like a more mainstream Polish national canon. So I had to discover it through, you know, seminar readings. And one of the readings that we just decided to discuss spontaneously was were The Neighbors. And then I started to feel that people, that, you know, one of the vectors of the, or indicators of the Polish politics is not so much division between right and left, but or some kind of, you know, socioeconomic programs, but the division between those who get Jan Tomasz Gross book and, you know, are sympathetic, and those who fiercely oppose it.
I see.
And this is a very kind of, you know, this is a kind of political division that, you know, I guess people like Adam Michnik embodies probably the best. But I realize that I'm sharing some of it, that for me it's important whether somebody is, you know, nationalist and anti-Semitic or not, although I knew still very little about my family at the time.
Mm-hmm. How do you see its role in Polish history, Polish historiography, public debate now? I mean, so it's out there. There's no putting that genie back in the bottle. Do you think that, I mean, there are a lot of discussions all over East Central Europe about various what the relationship of these countries and their people should be to the World War II past. I mean, that's pretty heavily laden, and I think there are a lot of places that where the discussion is kind of like, well, should it be a version of German Vergangenheitsbewältigung, mm-hmm. or should it be something else? What has Jan Gross's book done, in your view, in terms of, I mean, has it primarily polarized? Has it also produced some kind of third consensus? Has mm-hmm. it opened the way for other kinds of thinking? I mean, its overall impact, how would you assess that?
I think it was changing a lot. I mean, in the first place, I think it was just like opening a wound, and the reaction was very emotional on both sides of any kind of political divide, however you call it. And then when the emotions never really, I think,
died
out, but... I think what happened was that, and maybe, you know, apart from the historical arguments and these more academic debates, I think that the most interesting change happened on a local level, that some people, and now I think this number is growing, began to reorganize their mental landscapes. Mm-hmm. They, you know, you go to a small town and you suddenly think through Jewish shtetl when you try to make sense of this place where you are coming to. And I think the perception change, something that is kind of daily experience, and I think it's not. It's nationwide in some ways, because if you look at websites like Virtual Shtetl, mm-hmm. you see that many people really, both as on the, you know, philo-Semitic or anti-Semitic side, they now realize that this place was Jewish in some ways. Mm-hmm. So. And of course, I tend to focus much more on things that are positive and had been done, because I somehow want to see Poland changing towards a place where you confront the past. I don't, rather than given to fears and anxiety, because I don't think it's very helpful. So this kind of defense mechanism are understandable, and I can follow them, you know, kind of so psychologically I understand the mechanisms, but I rather look for, and I'm always like positively surprised by those who say like, wait a minute, mm-hmm. here is a, you know, cemetery, and Jewish cemetery should do something with it. And I think, you know, when you go from, well, you know, outside of Warsaw, which is anyway aspires to be cosmopolitan and so on, you see a kind of change in of landscape. And the same goes for German landscapes.
Oh,
In
so that
in
kind
Poland.
Of came together with...
Yeah, I mean, this happened already before Gross' book. So mm-hmm. this, you know, people like who are, you know, Donald Tusk, who is, you know, Polish prime minister, he wrote a book about Gdańsk and mm-hmm. rediscovered German Danzig for the present mm-hmm. dwellers of Gdańsk.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because people like Tusk and, let's say, the politics that have emerged more recently after, let's say, the fall of the Kaczynski brothers is oriented in a way that's more, it seems, open to this kind of historical interpretation that is, let's say, more broadly inclusive of the historical... you know, or of, you know, kind of the previous diversity of the Polish state. How much of that do you think was, you know, it was going to happen because it kind of, you know, like it was heading that way? And how much of it is just, do you think, like an accident or, you know, literally an accident, like the plane crash at, you know, near Smolensk, right? You know, where the one Kaczynski basically, you know, and a lot of other people disappeared, and so therefore a certain political option kind of deflated. You know, how much of that was probably in the cards anyway, and it just, you know, maybe unexpectedly accelerated it, and how much of it was just chance, like that it could have been very different?
Yeah, well, certainly both. I mean, when I look at this political and academic business of Polish-German reconciliation that was really very well financed in the 90s. I mean, there was a lot of money flowing dedicated to you know, reconcile Poles with the Germans. We went with the, you know, I guess many high school pupils went to Germany for a kind of exchange trip with the German students, you know, and there was a lot of it going on in the 90s. So it was a very, you know, meticulously and coordinated effort to change something here. Well, I think with some kind of, you know, effect that it's neither spectacular, you know, that without any kind of spectacular effect, but I think, you know, there is some recognition of, you know, and redefinition of early post-war time as ethnic cleansing rather than you know, evacuation or however you want to call it, displacement of Germans from Polish territories or from today's territories that today belong to Poland to the Germany. But I think with the Jewish, with this opening towards this Jewish-oriented multiculturalism, yes, I think here Gross was really dropped a bomb, and we may just guess whether Polish society needed an outsider or somebody who is, you know, in between to drop the bomb, or whether he played a function, you know, that was a kind of functional role he played or not. But I think he dropped a bomb, and without him, I don't think this would, Polish-Jewish relations would look the same. Although nowadays, I think it became much more an institutionalized affair with, you know, Museum of History of Polish Jewry opening in October 2014, and with the all of the sudden also a lot of money that Polish government is putting into all kinds of Polish Jewish initiatives. But it's interesting that it come that this all these initiatives come, you know, 10 years after Gross published his first book on Polish involvement in the Holocaust.
You know, it's interesting that you should mark that as a particularly significant moment, you know, for you and your kind of intellectual trajectory, because the history that you write is really not like that. I mean, it's so not like that. I mean, and as you said, I think, you know, the kind of history that you write is, you know, you've written about consumerism in Poland, and you write, you know, about socialism, and you're doing this project now about the way that East Central Europe, you know, had a role to play in, you know, kind of the production of social science around the Third World. So, you know, how do you get from, you know, like being shocked by Jan Gross to the kind of history that you write? Is it because you're looking for those places where, you can talk about a kind of Poland that is not World War II Poland, where everything is so stratified? Is it because mm-hmm. you're looking for the moments where people were actually in one boat, so to speak? Or is there something else in play? Because you mentioned yeah. that you were looking for points of kind of reconciliation, or you know, I don't remember the term that you used, but it's positive, mm-hmm. positive things. Mm-hmm. Is that the reason why you focus on these issues in your work? Or, you know, how did you come to this? Yeah. And is it at all related to your yeah. reading of Jan Gross?
Well, this is really an excellent question. I was thinking a lot about it because, of course, I try to be a self-reflective historian, and sometimes I use narrative to say that, you know, I'm somehow that I'm aware of my normative position. Mm-hmm. But when I was writing my first book about workers, I was basically, you know, fascinated by the group that became very just basically forgotten in the 90s, the worker and the socialist worker. This was something that, you know, nobody wanted to talk about, so outmoded, and somehow there was this you know, solidarity as a trade union existed, but the you know, working class was not the hero of new times. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of discussions about the winners and losers of transformation, a lot of really bad sociology being written in the 90s, but I somehow wanted to go back to this socialist worker. And
what inspired you to do that? I mean, did you have any...
And it was happening when I was reading Gross, you know, it was the very same time.
Wow.
So I think some part of me is I also thought that it's too personal. Mm-hmm. Because I thought it's you know, somehow I had this hierarchical vision of what makes you a good writer, that you need some kind of experience and wisdom to deal with things that really touch you emotionally. And I wasn't ready to write some kind of, you know, MA thesis on something that which is so important.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I thought that, you know, a format of an MA thesis is not worth it. You know, you know, it's like, okay,
so
I mean,
like an etude more.
Yeah, it's just an MA thesis. I found it, you know, it's a good exercise to, and I was, you know, genuinely fascinated in all these socialist worlds of the past that I discovered, you know, in my research, but I somehow compartmentalized my interest, and I decided this is personal and private, and this is, mm-hmm. you know, official academic, what I put on the table, and this is what I publish. And I guess later, when I was writing my book on consumerism about, you know, short, you know, experience, you know, this shortage economy in Poland. I, at the very same time, I attended a seminar of Barbara Engelking-Boni, mm-hmm. and it was a time when I was discovering, when I discovered all these documents about my grandfather and how he had to go, went through the trial and was accused, you know, of collaborating. And you know, these topics, of course, consumed me, you know, were extremely important for me. But I also thought, and I attempted to write a paper for Barbara Engelking-Boni for this seminar about Jewish honor courts.
Mm-hmm.
And I did two attempts, and I stopped and I wrote a long explanation why I cannot write this paper. Explain, basically, you know, making my failure to finish it into a topic of my seminar paper. So, you know, it's somewhere in my head, and in this new topic, I definitely go look more into also, you know, I start to explore this Polish Jewish history, but still through kind of a back door of, you know, history of ideas or intellectual history, like not to confront too much with things that, you know, so this is this whole normal, you know, I'm very much aware of this normative level, and also I wanted to avoid topics that had to do with three things, and I became aware of it. Religion, completely absent. I don't feel the topic in any way. The second thing, well, something that I'm now doing, but in the past I didn't deal with it intellectual. So when I was writing in my MA and my PhD, I somehow intellectuals and kind of big figures, I found them somehow to, I was not interested in it. And so, you know, these interests are changing. And also, I guess what happens is now...
Wait, what was the third one? Religion, intellectuals?
And yeah.
Oh, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
If you think of it later. Go ahead, you were saying.
Yeah. And I think what... and there's it's very interesting that when I look at my colleagues and friends from my history seminar... you know, Błażej Brzostek, Joanna Wawrzyniak, Marcin Zaremba, this whole generation of scholars, we are all, you know, were supervised by Marcin Kula, so this is somehow quite a coherent milieu, that we all somehow move from studying communist Poland to... at least in my generation, to a kind of broader history of the 20th century and looking beyond Poland. So there is some kind of invisible chemistry that is there, that somehow we move to some, we enlarge our topics. And I think we all came to a conclusion at the very same time that, you know, you cannot understand communist Poland, surprise, surprise, without understanding World War II and everything that was before. But, you know, we basically, it seems like when we, I was starting, when I started to write, this communist Poland was a, you know,
self-contained
unit of study. And, well, the scholarship is not bad, but, you know, a lot of these monographs are worth something, and mine is, you know, including mine, but, you know, I would definitely write it differently.
Was Jan Gross important for that transition as well? I mean, because you wrote that book on kind of war as a revolution, or the, you know, the, or was that something that was on people's, it's an earlier book, right?
Yes, but, you know, until today it wasn't translated into Polish.
Really? Oh, that's interesting.
So I read it when I was in, much later, and you know, it's a book that you have hard time to assign to your students in at Polish universities.
Yeah, well, because I guess it's not translated. Okay, so you have lived and worked academically in Poland, Germany, and the United States. Maybe you could talk a bit about how you see the different perspectives on, you know, let's say our field, East Central Europe, that are offered by these three academic environments. I mean, has there been a convergence between them, or are there notable differences in the preoccupations of these different places with regard to the history that you've been dealing with, or the region more generally?
Yeah, well, I think that the kind of contemporary history I was immersed in, you know, you know, since my studies was this a little bit ahistorical history, I would call it like that, you know, a lot of stress on interdisciplinarity, applying concepts from sociology or anthropology into historical material, but without historicizing really, but rather analyzing sociologically something that is the past, but this past, you know, could be dynamic because there would be a story, but it would not be, you know, the categories themselves would not be historicized, but rather some kind of, you know, historical sociology as it probably existed in Ann Arbor in Michigan in the 70s, you know. And I think that when I went to Berlin, I discovered that history can be historical.
Can you elaborate? Interrogation of concepts, Begriffsgeschichte. So
Begriffsgeschichte, right, history of concepts, and also that, you know, I mean, it's really, I think that German humanities are, you know, both historical sciences and philosophy are just fantastic in analyzing the phenomenon of time in general, and also the language is so fascinating, the way you can combine different words and make it into some kind of new word creations that invent new, also, you know, that you can basically invent new concept, you know, every now and then, or like on and on. And but in what does it mean that history became historical for me? It means that I started to understand that all the categories that I use and that I use myself and that I borrow from other disciplines, and also all the language present in the sources is, you know, somehow you know, has its own temporality and its own historical dimension, which sounds like, you know, ABC of a historian, but believe me, in Warsaw, in this in my circle, when interdisciplinarity was, you know, basically praised and dominated over, you know, historicity or something like, you know, historical dimension of the past, you know, for me it was not a revelation, but something that I finally started to apply, because of course I was aware of, like, yes, those who deal with Middle Ages do it, and probably those who work on 19th century also do it, but I think we historians of, you know, post-war Poland were not very good in historicizing our material, and maybe I'm generalizing too much, but I definitely can apply it to myself.
Well, you have something in common with Jan Gross then, in some respects, because he also comes out of a sociological background and then comes into writing history. So is there something Polish about that trajectory? Why is sociology the kind of entree into history in Poland? I mean, because this is something that you yourself are historicizing now, potentially, right? When you write about the emergence of the social sciences in Poland. So how did, you know, what is particularly Polish about this story, if anything? Like, why do Polish sociologists become Polish historians?
But I think historically sociology attracted you know, a lot of you know, first rate, you know, it was attractive for intellectuals, and it was, you know, I also studied sociology because I knew that my other students and the whole atmosphere of studying will be more interesting than department of history that was dominated by, you know, 90-year-old boys, you know, fascinated with, you know,
battles.
battles and you know, wearing military suits to in their classroom. Mm-hmm. So I think there was something in you know, very attractive in sociology that it was you know, so intellectual, while history was a kind of
antiquarian
on the one hand, and also infantile in some ways. I mean, it's when I look at these boys who are in the classroom. No, it's just an anecdote. I think that there is a, you know, strong tradition of interdisciplinarity that was strengthened by this kind of golden age of post-war Polish humanities, you know, kind of open Marxism signed by, you wouldn't know, that represented by people like Witold Kula, mm-hmm. Bauman, and philosophy, mm-hmm. you know. Well, Andrzej Walicki was not really a Marxist, but other people like Kołakowski. So it was an important idiom. There was something about being an Eastern European or East Central European intellectual that you have to kind of combine or be inspired by different
political theory, philosophy, sociology.
Yes. This is not very systematic knowledge, but you are supposed to. I think this is what makes this phenomenon of East Central European intellectual so you know, distinct. And then you know, our little seminar run by Marcin Kula, that the stress was put on really asking problems rather than, you know, diving in, you know, making past kind of historical and deep, but rather, you know, very analytical framework. And because sociology was so powerful, and now I think it's no more because of this transitology that really was a blow. Yeah. At least, I mean, maybe sociology is now recovering, but in the 90s it became, you know, a poor step I don't know, child of the Western political sciences. It wasn't good for Polish sociology. Mm-hmm. Yes, and then you also have, and I think that stress, another reason why there is so much stress on this, you know, a little bit historical theorizing or kind of applying of sociological concept to historical material is a reaction towards very descriptive historiography, so-called faktograph, you know, this kind of history of events and days that is really not intellectually innovative, I would say. Yeah. Let's put it this way. So I think, so there is a kind of another extreme is to just be, you know, like, let's apply social sciences to history rather than... There is some kind of a strange tension between this kind of monographies a la German historical school, you know, very outdated type of writing, but it still exists in Germany, of course, right? There's a lot of, like, tradition of writing very narrow monographic works, and it's...
Yeah. So I want to make sure that I ask you about the Polish chair, so I'll ask you about that first, and then maybe we can go back to 1989, because I'd like to talk about that a little bit more. So as of July 1st, you're to be the first to occupy the Polish Studies professorship at Columbia, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the Polish chair and what you think or what your vision is for what can be done from that position.
I think that the challenge is, and I think it turned up in your previous interviews, is that what do you do with, not just with the Polish history, but Eastern Central European history in this era of post-area studies, where area studies are shrinking or becoming, you know, are dominated by of global histories and international histories, especially in Colombia, where you have a very strong focus on international history, which I don't think it's a problem, but I think it's a challenge to show why shall we have a, you know, chair of Polish history. I think it's a legitimate question to ask. So my concern, and I think the challenge, is to really open up, really revisit different narratives, and see what sticks. This is how you call it in English.
Yeah.
You know? what works. And I think it's a very exploratory, a kind of an you know, experimental site or place where you play with different ideas and you just see what happens. I mean, it sounds very elusive, but I think it doesn't have to be like, oh, Poland has to be now, or East Central Europe must be must be part of the global history and how we should do it. So, you know, sometimes you ask questions that lead towards this kind of, geographically,
expansive
narratives, and my project is like that. But I think you can tell the story through the lens of, you know, one village, and which can be also extremely fascinating. And you know, I think it's a good time, the kind of time of crisis, to definitely revisit national history. But I don't think if it's necessary in the case of U.S. Kind of North Atlantic field of, North Atlantic history of Eastern Europe, or this kind of field that is here, exists in U.S. academia. So I'm not sure. I think that many, So definitely, I think it will be a very open, open space, and I think I also would like to work more on linking Polish topics with, Jewish, Russian, German history, and also the history of the more broadly Eastern and Southeastern Europe. I think here there is still a lot to do. There are still many topics to be discovered.
So when you think about, if you're thinking in terms of East Central European history, and you have graduate students who work with you in this field, like, what do you think? Is there a skill set that you think somebody who works in this field should enter with, or is it always tailored to the particular student's interest, or is there something kind of field-like about the body of knowledge that should be sort of, brought to them, let's say, or given to them, or forced upon them?
Because I was switching between different disciplines all the time, I tend to be quite anarchic, and I think these frameworks are always shifting. But I think, apart from language skills, and I think, you need definitely at least two. You need at least to know two languages of the region to work on any kind of East Central European topic. I think there must be an awareness of a basic understanding or a deep understanding of official, unofficial, and kind of skills that you maybe need as a kind of reading between the lines, and very critical, really excellent skills of critical reading. And I think you know, I think I failed myself a little bit to do it because I was critical towards, you know, official communist documents, but I wasn't critical enough towards my apparatus that I was applying. So, but this, of course, comes. Right. This is something else, but I think this kind of interplay between official, unofficial, things happening on the backstage, like an awareness of you know, like a multiplicity or you know, variety of different layers that, you know, as you said yourself, you know, exist at the same somewhere else, that exists at the same time. Mm-hmm. That are played out, and I think that we have to think about, I mean, still, you know, the role of the state, but also non, you know, spaces where state is does not really exist, and also awareness of that institutions are very flexible structures. You know, I think it's very typical for East Central Europe. That you have on the one that there is kind of duality in the life of institutions, that it needs to be taken into account. I kind of, this constitutes for me kind of a feel for East Central European history, mm-hmm. and otherwise, I think it can be a topic that it's about, you know, anthropology of the present. Even the comparative work, but of course comparisons are extremely difficult, and I'm not sure if it's, you know, it's a very difficult to handle, and all kinds of, you know, transnational or histories that go beyond, you know, state boundaries are of course, you know, welcomed.
Are there any books that you've read that, you know, might be considered to be in the field of East Central European history, or more, you know, kind of broadly, or books in general, actually, mm-hmm. that you've read recently, you think, okay, this person's on to something, this is good?
Yes, I read one book that was really revealing for me, which is not from our field, but it's connected. Oh. Andrew Zimmerman, Africa in Alabama. Oh. And his previous article, Decolonizing Weber, about the way how German social sciences at the beginning of the 20th century that talked a lot about Eastern European rural workers, mm-hmm. How the expertise on this connection between German, you know, this knowledge of German borderlands populated by Slavic populations or visited by Slavic populations, like kind of Slavic guest workers,
right.
since the late 19th
kind of
century.
Our field, then.
Yeah, but how this experience then was translated by in the you know, American South,
wow.
and how you can connect it with you know, Booker Washington, people like histories of Booker Washington, Dubois, who visited, you know, had his, one of his best friends in Europe was Karol Estreicher from Krakow. Yes, yeah, so this the Africa in Alabama, there is also basically it's a story that then goes to, continues in Africa. So I found this whole, you know, transatlantic history of social sciences that seriously take East Central Europe into account. And kind of looks at how people like Max Weber and others in other scholars in Germany used this these ideas to look at the American South and how these ideas stayed there too. So this is really fascinating, because it really enlarges our perspective.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention relevance. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, this has been tremendously interesting, so thank you very much. And we'll talk about 1989 some other time, maybe at the 30th anniversary.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.